listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Good morning, it is 11 a.m. on Friday, July 18th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be covering some of the latest updates from City Council last week, some headlines directly from the heart of the city, and more. After a long debate at their July 8th meeting, Council voted down a motion to remove the 924 Sydenham Road property from consideration for a homeless shelter. The city purchased the property located at 924 Sydenham Road with the intent of establishing a 30-bed shelter to open late in 2025. This shelter marks the first step in geographically redistributing shelter operations and preparing for the closure of the Adelaide Street Shelter at 38 County Street. City staff held a public meeting on May 29th, during which many residents of the neighborhood expressed concerns with the proposed location due to the amount of elderly people and young families in the neighborhood, the busy road, as well as its proximity to the Cataraqui Cemetery, also a National Historical Site, and the elementary school Destiny Christian Academy. These concerns prompted Councillor Paul Shaves to put forward a motion to remove the 924 Sydenham Road property from consideration for a shelter. A line of delegation spoke before council in support of the motion. President John Armstrong represented residents of Cataraqui North, including the 1,090 who signed a petition to remove the site from consideration.
Some may say this is just a case of not in my backyard, but what we are really asking for is fair, responsible planning that respects the safety of seniors, the character of this neighborhood, and the lessons learned from past shelter sites. We are deeply alarmed and frankly dismayed by Council's decision to place a 17 to 45 bed homeless shelter at 924 Sydenham Road. We feel blindsided. We all know the reality. Where shelters go, issues follow, from uncontrolled drug use to inappropriate behavior to encampments. These challenges will spill into our parks, playgrounds, and streets.
Jenny Paquette, board chair of Destiny Christian Academy, and Craig Bowles, general manager of the Cataraqui Cemetery, shared the concerns of their respective organizations before council.
Our primary concern is the safety of our students and their younger siblings, many of whom use the school's outdoor spaces daily. These spaces are essential for their growth, play, and their sense of security. With deep respect, we must acknowledge that unmanaged proximity to individuals facing complex mental health and addiction challenges could create unpredictable and unsafe environments, especially in an area heavily used by our children. This is not about stigma. This is about ensuring thoughtful, responsible placement of services that consider proximity to vulnerable youth.
Shelter users absolutely have rights, but so do grieving families, so do religious communities, so does the public who use and rely on cemeteries as sacred and dignified spaces. By placing a shelter beside the cemetery, council is creating a conflict. The solution is clear: relocate the shelter. This removes the very real and likely instances of verbal altercation, aggressive behavior, loitering, trespass, encampment, substance abuse, discarded paraphernalia, noise disturbances. I can continue. These are not stereotypes. These are documented realities and behavioral issues that come with shelters. So again, cemeteries are not just parcels of land. They are sacred community assets. The decision to place a shelter besides a cemetery appears to have overlooked the sanctity of an active community that is dedicated to mourning, religious observance, reflection, mental wellness, tourism, community dignity.
Mark Finnegan, a Sydenham Road resident who lives directly across from the proposed shelter site, stressed the safety concern of the high speeds and traffic on Sydenham Road.
So I had my niece sit there with a radar gun yesterday and clock cars going up the road. It was average speeds of 66 kilometers an hour. An average impact of a car to a person is about 80% fatality at that speed. There was people driving at 80, 75 was a regular. And that's just one day. That's on a Monday. On Fridays, I couldn't get her there sooner on a Friday. On Fridays, it's much worse. People who are mentally ill, on drugs, walking up and down the most one of the busiest streets in Kingston. I guarantee you somebody's going to die here. I'm not telling you maybe somebody's going to die here. Someone will die here. It will be on all of you. I know two of you voted against it. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And thank you, Paul, for bringing this back up. This, somebody will die. Guaranteed.
Many councillors echoed the concerns of the delegations that came forward, including councillors Lisa Osanek and Gary Osteroff.
I did agree to this location originally, but I'm convinced now I made a mistake doing that. It's the unforeseen circumstance, like the unforeseen consequences to the cemetery, like a National Historic Cemetery, and we could be ruining it, and that just completely petrifies me.
I really, really see this as something we missed. I think this is just a really, really bad location for this task and the mission that it will have. It's basically inaccessible. It's inaccessible, to be, especially safely-wise. We have to acknowledge that, because if we don't acknowledge it tonight when we have a chance, it's on us. Like, I don't know what we're going to do to slow that traffic down. We saw it very clearly.
However, other councillors were willing to move forward with the site. Councillors Connie Glenn and Wendy Stevens stressed the urgency of the homelessness crisis and the lack of other options.
City staff have given a lot of thought to this. So I think that some of the comments that I heard about staff didn't consider this or that or the next thing simply isn't true. There was a ton of consideration, effort, and work that went into this. So at this time, I can't support this motion. I know that that's not what a number of members of the community want to hear, but I don't think that we will ever get out of the situation we're in if we are not bold and take these steps.
No one is designing neighborhoods saying, oh, we'll put a school here, have commercial over here. This is where the homeless shelter will go. That's not how we plan a city, because nobody expected it to get this bad. So, very reluctantly, I will not be supporting this motion, but it's not because I think shelters are good. It's not because I think they work, but I think it's because it's the only thing we can do.
Councillors Gregory Ridge, Vincent Chinani, and Don Amos reflected on the lessons the city has learned from past shelters, including the importance of spreading out services, the size of the shelter, and day programming.
I think that based on the community consultation that has happened with regards to the Adelaide Street Shelter, staff have very much heard what needs to be done to move forward with improving any shelters.
The shelters that are further away in other areas, you don't hear about problems from them, because the way I see it is people don't want to be near the hub. You know, some people want to be away from that. They want to, you know, have a bed and not have to worry about all the worries that everyone else has with the shelters that are problematic. And like I said, we've learned a lot of lessons. Like, smaller is better. So I think it's a good thing to spread things out.
I requested a meeting with Lionheart's Executive Director, Travis, who is running the Adelaide Street Shelter, and had a discussion with him about lessons learned. He talked about a holistic approach. He talked about not just being a shelter service, but providing client service to get them back on that right track. Of not waking up going, I didn't choose to do this. I didn't choose to be homeless. About helping them getting their life back in order so that they can take that positive step forward. We are that safety net. Adelaide is not working. It's too big. Staff and the operator have both said a smaller system can work. I think we need to move forward in this direction.
Councillor Ryan Bohm pointed to the larger issue of a lack of support from upper levels of government, mentioning that he may be bringing an advocacy-based motion forward in the near future, calling on the province to step up.
There's no win here. That's the problem, right? So we're struggling with a crisis that is not of our making. Mental health, addictions, lack of treatment centers, and I guess in a sense, we're all angry. I'm angry. I'm angry that we're sitting here at 11 o'clock at night debating what is at best a stopgap measure that will impose a temporary shelter service facility in an area that really isn't right for it, in my opinion. But at the same time, we're also facing that if we don't put it here, where do we put them? And we have short Canadian summers. So can staff find a spot? Or are we just going to end up with encampments or people freezing to death? So I kind of see a damned if you do, damned if you do approach here. But we're wrestling with things that, frankly, we are not equipped financially as a city to solve. And we keep going around and around and we get frustrated and we want to do good and we want to solve it. But realistically, we can't solve this on our own. If the other levels of government don't want to come and play ball, then we have to start calling them out.
After much debate, Mayor Brian Patterson brought forward a compromise, offering to add a new motion which would require a review and re-evaluation of the shelter after 6 months of operation.
I think one of the issues that we're trying to get at here is that the location of the shelter seems to matter. The location in a certain area of the city seems to create a lot of secondary negative impacts. And when you take that shelter out of that area, it seems to be far more manageable and actually can work. But I also appreciate the very legitimate concerns from the cemetery, from the Christian school up the road, from the surrounding neighborhoods. These are not things that can be dismissed. So what do we do? So here's my conclusion. If this motion fails, then I will immediately put forward a new motion tonight that would put a 6 month timeline on this. Get us through the winter, because the winter, obviously, that's when shelter spaces are most important. And let's see what happens. Obviously, we want this to succeed. But I'll be honest with you, if any of these issues or concerns actually occur, in my view, that's not a success. And so if we try this out and it doesn't work, then I will bring forward a motion to remove the shelter at that point, and we look for somewhere else.
Councillor Shaves' motion to remove the site from consideration lost by a vote of 8-5. Mayor Patterson's new motion came to the floor afterwards and was supported unanimously by council, with the addition that all shelters would be subject to this review process.
You'll see the timeline from the opening of the shelter, 6 months. The direction to staff is to report back with detailed operational review, including anything feedback from police, bylaw, and most importantly, the neighborhood liaison committee. And so in my view, that information will then give council the opportunity to say, obviously, one of two things, either it's working and it can continue, or if it's not working, then we pull the plug. The other point I think that's I would say is that obviously, if we're going to do this review for this shelter, I think it's fair that we do this review for other shelters as well. Because at the end of the day, right, we understand that there have been those issues around shelters, so we need to be able to monitor and to be able to react accordingly. I think that that's, we owe our citizens, all citizens, that approach, trying to navigate through this very difficult issue, as many people have already said. I think that this is the best middle ground that I can possibly come up with here to be able to proceed with the shelter.
Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today, featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Friday, July 18th, we have a couple of showers in the forecast with the possibility of a thunderstorm that will cut down on some of the humidity, but it's still going to feel like 30 degrees here in the city of Kingston. Moving into the weekend, Saturday, July 19th, probably the nicest day of the week. It's going to be 26, but only feel like 28. Beautiful, sunny climate and conditions. Sunday, July 20th, we are expecting rain, a 73% chance of precipitation. precipitation. Daytime high of 25, feeling like 26. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, July 21st, it'll be 26 degrees with plenty of beautiful sunshine. Here is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The LaSalle Causeway will be closed on Sunday, July 20th from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. Moving on to the road closures for the week, Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Abidon Road, Highway 2 to Middle is closed until August 15th for the removal and replacement of a culvert. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Baggett Street, Berry to West is closed July 16th at 7 a.m. to July 23rd at 7 p.m. to accommodate pedestrian and participant safety for the Canadian Little League Championship. Brock Street, Division 2 Palace is closed July 14th to 31st from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. each day for road resurfacing. Carlton Street, Alfred to Guy closed until August 8th for a gas main installation. Creighton Street at Chatham closed July 14th to 17th from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. each day to accommodate the removal of existing water and sanitary sewer services. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Guy Street, Carlton to Division is closed until August 8th for a gas main installation. King Street, Place d'Armes to Tragically Hip Way closed July 14th to 27th for Paw Patrol event-related parking and storage at Slush Puppy Place. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen is closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Victoria Street, Princess to North Bartlett is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. And Wise Street, Woodbine to Megan is closed until July 31st to accommodate construction of a new sidewalk and road improvements. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Accommodation Road, 6th concession to Whitechurch, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Abidon Road, middle to Highway 2, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Bayridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Catterockway Woods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Collins Bay Road, Woodbine to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work on Collins Bay Road. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic is down to one lane in each direction. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Garrett Road, 6th concession to Sand Hill, expect delays while a contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Highway 2 to Abidon and St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abidon Road, Highway 2 and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users. Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes the site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main sidewalks and road, and Whitechurch Road, 6th concession to Woodburn, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. In a message directly from downtown Kingston, Kingston Buskers Rendezvous came to an end on Sunday evening with a grand finale that saw a tie for the People's Choice Award for only the third time in the festival's 35-year history. The Twins Trip, a dynamic duo of identical twins from Argentina who made their Canadian debut, tied with seasoned circus artist Richard Philby from London by way of Australia. Winning People's Choice means the performers are invited to return next year to once again wow audiences. United Way's Success by Six program was also a winner at this year's grand finale, with proceeds raised by the performers as they passed the hat benefiting the program. Success by Six is a United Way initiative set up to help improve the lives of Kingston's youngest children. Success by Six is based on the idea that it takes a village to raise a child, and we all have a role to play in ensuring every child has a chance to succeed early in life. Thousands of people flocked to this year's festival, which featured a number of new elements, including Juggle Junction, a designated kids' play area funded by the Government of Ontario. Complete with large inflatables, Juggle Junction also offered collaborative coloring tables, live music, and a busker boot camp where festival performers taught workshops on juggling, beatboxing, balloon twisting, and more. Sandy Griffiths, events manager with Downtown Kingston, states, quote, "The Kingston Buskers Rendezvous once again proved to be an outstanding success as enthusiastic crowds gathered to celebrate the incredible talents of our performers. Despite the blistering hot temperatures, the dedication and generosity of our attendees continued all weekend. We are immensely grateful for the continued support and look forward to many more years of memorable performances and community engagement," end quote. Plans are already underway for next year's Kingston Buskers Rendezvous, which will take place from July 9th to 12th, 2026. Once again, that was a message directly from downtown Kingston regarding last weekend's Kingston Buskers Rendezvous. In a message directly from the city of Kingston, Emancipation Day celebrations, remembering the past and working towards a better future. August 1st is Emancipation Day, marking the day Britain's Parliament abolished slavery across most of the British Empire in 1834. It has since become an annual day of remembrance and reflection on the struggle for human rights and the ongoing work to eliminate racism and discrimination in Canada. To recognize Emancipation Day in Kingston, a flag-raising ceremony with Mayor Patterson, members of council, and local community leaders will take place at 11:30 a.m., followed by a community services fair from 12:30 to 3 p.m., both in Confederation Park on Friday, August 1st. Vanessa Mensa, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Manager with the City of Kingston, states, quote, "Emancipation Day asks us not only to remember that slavery existed, but to confront how its legacies still live on. It's a call to reckon with the past, honor the strength of those who survived it, and challenge the systems that continue to deny true freedom today. Attending the city's Emancipation Day event is more than just showing up. It's an act of recognition, a step toward learning, and a commitment to building a more just and equitable future together," end quote. Emancipation Day is free to attend and open to all ages. To learn more about Emancipation Day, you can visit the city's website. Once again, that was a message directly from the City of Kingston about the upcoming Emancipation Day celebrations on August 1st in Confederation Park. The City of Kingston has also sent along an update from an item on Council's agenda last week. On Tuesday, July 8th, Kingston City Council approved a naming rights agreement for the expanded swimming dock and new water play area in Flora McDonald Confederation Basin. The site will be officially named Patry Aquatic Park in recognition of a $1 million in-kind sponsorship from Patry Group. As part of its efforts to attract new investment and non-tax-based funding sources, the city has explored naming rights for locations within major capital projects. An enhanced swimming dock and inflatable water park at Battery Park will be constructed as part of the broader Confederation Basin Promenade project, using this in-kind support. The addition of the inflatable water park at Patry Aquatic Park will offer an affordable, family-friendly recreation option in the heart of downtown Kingston. Designed to be accessible and inclusive, the park will provide a fun and safe environment for children, youth, and families to enjoy the waterfront. This investment ensures that more residents can access engaging outdoor activities close to home. The agreement will grant Patry Group naming rights until the end of the swimming dock's useful life, anticipated to be approximately 20 years. The contribution includes equipment and materials to support the installation of the public swim facilities and amenities. Amy Elgersma, Director of Recreation and Leisure Services, states, quote, "This generous contribution from Patry Group provides an exciting opportunity for enhanced swimming opportunities at our waterfront. The Patry Aquatic Park will offer residents and visitors a place to connect, play, and cool off, creating memorable experiences in the heart of Kingston's downtown for years to come. The agreement with Patry Group represents a major milestone in the city's ongoing efforts to support accessible and vibrant public spaces. Patry Water Park is scheduled to open in 2027. Once again, that was an update directly from the City of Kingston on City Council's decision to approve naming rights partnership for the new Waterfront Aquatic Park.
The Kingston General Hospital Auxiliary has made a significant investment in local healthcare, presenting Kingston Health Sciences Centers with $314,650 at their 120th annual general meeting last week. President of the Auxiliary, Chelsea Reynolds, spoke with CFRC about the accomplishment after difficult years during and following the pandemic.
So leading into COVID, we had been in the middle of a 7-year commitment. We had pledged $2.5 million. And so it was a little bit of a struggle in 2020, 21, 22 to meet that commitment because things hadn't been, you know, we'd shut down, the cafe was a little bit limited, and so it was hard. And now, yeah, we've ramped right back up and we're back to where we had been pre-COVID. So it's very exciting.
Between the consistent effort, generous donors, and other programs returning, all efforts came together to bring the total back to pre-COVID numbers.
We've been able to open back up our lottery booth. It had closed for COVID, and then we opened again in the fall of 23. So that has helped. And the cafe has just been a very steady growth again. And we always like to say, like, we really rely on our staff there, and shout out to our manager in particular, who's done a really good job. She's always looking for, you know, fresh and local and, you know, suppliers that she can work with on what we need throughout the year. So that has helped. And our staff, like not our staff, but the staff in the hospital are extremely loyal. Like we have people that line up, you know, they know the specials that are coming up and, you know, they commit to getting their lunches there. So that's fantastic. So yeah, it's just been sort of a, you know, a whole bunch of different things that have, you know, just built back up.
The Auxiliary chose to commit to a selection of items to make an immediate impact, a slight shift after their previous commitment towards redevelopment at the hospital.
So last year, I think we gave, I think it was $250,000. And so then this year we've been able to up it a little bit. But that money went towards redevelopment, which was what that 7-year commitment had been. And now redevelopment is on hold on the hospital's end. And so as a group, we decided we wanted to do something that would be a little more immediate, a little more in action right away kind of thing. So that's why we've gone with the $314,000. We're doing NICU ventilators and we're doing the oncology treatment chairs. And those are things that can be purchased in the short term and, you know, be used right away in the hospital. So
the total allowed them to make significant headway, exceeding expectations.
Like the oncology chairs, there was supposed to be a 3-year commitment. They were hoping to get 5 every year, and we had enough money that we could do all 15. So we can just tick that one off the list and we'll see what comes up next year.
In all, the funds will be used to purchase a point-of-care ultrasound machine for the pediatric program, 4 NICU ventilators, and 15 oncology treatment chairs. In addition, the KGH Auxiliary is also providing educational funding for KHSC staff through the annual Millennium Bursary Fund, as well as supporting elder life and critical care programs. The group came together at their annual general meeting last week to announce the total and celebrate.
This was our best turnout at our AGM since before COVID as well, because I think everybody was excited to see that amount and to, you know, do you feel like you're part of the group that's working towards something together? And, you know, like I do with the lottery booth and you think, oh, well, you know, it's just a couple hours, a couple times a week, but like every little bit counts and you're contributing. And so, yeah, everybody has been really excited. And I know Dr. Pecora and the staff at the hospital had also come to the meeting and, you know, offered lots of appreciation to our volunteers.
Sandy Pines Wildlife Center in Napanee recently welcomed an unexpected guest, a small creature far from home whose journey is still unfolding. The story began after receiving a call from a manufacturer reporting a strange animal found in a shipping container. Sue Meach, director of Sandy Pines, recounts the unusual call they received on the evening of June 16th.
We got a call from some people in Belleville that worked at an auto parts store. They said that they had a Mexican raccoon in a bin, and it had been there for a day, and they put some water in, but they didn't know what to do with it.
Sandy Pines volunteer Greg Oosting was sent to investigate the next day. What he found was certainly not a raccoon, but needed help nonetheless.
I said, be prepared for what you see. I'm really not sure what this is, but we need to help the animal. Anyway, he got there and he said, well, this isn't a raccoon, but I'm going to catch it anyway. And it's going to die if it stays in here. So he was able to trap it. And then it was brought into us by a volunteer.
Once at the center, staff quickly identified the visitor as a caco missile, a small nocturnal mammal native to Central America, characterized by its dark-ringed tail.
It's a very small mammal. It's only weighs less than a kilogram. So it's very small, about half the size of a cat, maybe a six-month-old kitten. And it has a long tail with beautiful gray and white stripes, or black and white stripes, actually, all the way up. At first, we were told it was a lemur, but when we did our homework and started looking it up online, we realized that it couldn't be a lemur because lemurs come from Africa. So we did a bit of research and discovered that there was a similar species in South America or Central America, and it was commonly known as a ringtail, but the technical name is a caco missile. So it arrived, and at least we knew what we were getting, and we were prepared somewhere for him. They like trees to climb, so we had a barn stall set up with trees in it, branches in it that have been donated by very generous people who trim their trees and bring branches in for our animals. And we set up a nice little den in there for him, and in he went. Apparently, the company in Belleville makes headlights for vehicles, and they pack up the headlights in sea cans and sends them to Mexico. Mexico then sends back the empty sea can, and somehow this little guy, I can see how he's so small, if he'd gotten into the corner of a really big sea can in the dark, when you looked in, you wouldn't spot him right away.
While the stowaway made its discomfort known, it was coping well under the unusual circumstances. The question now was how to return it home, or at the very least, to a safe environment.
So then it was the dilemma of what is the legal process for handling a situation like this. We did have this happen once with a bird. We had an albatross here many years ago that was not indigenous to Canada. So, but that was with Canadian Wildlife Services that do the avian species. So I reached out to the Ministry of Natural Resources, and who I'm a custodian, I have a license under their authority, and they said, well, it wasn't their department, called the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. They deal with animals crossing the border, apparently, whether they're exotics or food animals that are coming in. Anyway, they laughed when I called them and said, well, it's funny that you should call us, because we got a call from Belleville and they said to bring the animal to you and call you. So I was going round in circles here.
Meech began reaching out for guidance and suggestions. Eventually, she connected with Lee Parker, zoo director at Little Rays Nature Center, an exotic animal rescue located in Ottawa.
But I have a friend who's a vet in Ottawa, and she had told me that she works with exotics. So I explained to her that we had this caca missile, and we were quite happy to give him temporary accommodation, but obviously he needed something more than we could give him, maybe even try to get him back to Mexico. She contacted me back and said, Little Rays has a nature center in Ottawa, and she's the veterinarian in charge there. And she checks all the animals as a volunteer. And she thought that would be the best place for him while we figured out a solution for this little guy. So I contacted Lee at the nature center, and he said that this was an unusual case, and they usually seem to get calls about reptiles and snakes, but he would be very happy to help. So he even said that they would come and pick up the animal, which was a great help because this is such a busy time for us. Anyway, he came, and we had him all packed up, his bags packed and everything, and off he went.
While smaller reptiles or amphibians sometimes slip into Canada, this case involving a mammal is a less common occurrence, according to Parker.
So with mammals in Canada, I mean, I've been in Canada for 17 years, going on 18 years, and we often get smaller animals like reptiles and amphibians come through, and they often come through either in fruit or flowers and things like that, which is a little bit, I mean, it's not, you don't get it every month or so on, but I mean, we do hear it, and it's often probably a lot of them that don't even survive. Because they often put chillers on the flowers or the fruit and stuff, and food goes into cold storage and things like that, and a lot of these animals probably won't survive. But for mammals, in the time that I've been at Little Rays, this is our first one that we've I'd heard of coming through like this, but I'm sure it's not the only case of it.
The Kako missile was transferred to Little Rays Nature Center just before the long weekend. Now safely housed at Little Rays, work is being done to determine its origin and what next steps can be taken.
So really the process that we have when something like this comes in, when I got the call from Susan, I mean, Susan does a lot of rescue for native species. And when you have something that's exotic coming in or from another country, you have to be cautious about cross-contamination, especially if you're having animals going back into the wild. So she reached out to me saying, would Little Rays be able to take this animal on so that it had a place to go, and then we could either try and figure out a way to get it back to where it came from, or if not that and it couldn't leave Canada, then where would we be able to find a forever home for this animal should it need to be there? So the steps that have happened right now is that I've gone through the CFIA, which is Canadian Food Inspection Agency. They deal with balls as well as food and things like into Canada. And I was on a call with them 3 times yesterday, and they obviously often don't get this either. So they are working through this currently with me to find out what the best option is and what the steps going forward is with this animal. Since then, we have reached out to a facility that is willing to take it should the CFIA deem that fit for the animal. But at this point in time, it is in our quarantine. We are maintaining him. He's eating. He's a wild animal, so he's not used to people. So we're keeping him under as little stress as possible. We're not overactive in the habitat or anything like that. We go in, we do our routine maintenance of cleaning, feeding, and water changing and stuff like that, monitoring, make sure he's okay. And then once we hear back from the CFIA, we can then proceed with steps for any further veterinary care, whether he needs to have rabies vaccinations, a body checkup, make sure everything's where it needs to be, maybe make sure there's no other illnesses or maybe some blood work and things like that before he actually gets moved on to his forever home. If he ends up finding out where he came from, that's what the CFIA are trying to do, to see exactly where this container came from in the United States, Mexico area. That's where these guys are found, because some of these animals in certain areas are critically endangered. So obviously if this is an animal in that situation, we would rather get this animal back to where he came from. And that's what we're working on currently.
While Sandy Pines will be getting back to business as usual, mostly rescuing native species, they remain committed to helping in any way they can with a resolution, whether that means a return to the wild or a safe new home.
They said they had a nice big area for him with some trees in it, so he would be safe in there until they could figure out something. Some department of the government is going to have to be involved. And if he is being sent anywhere, we will have to get permits and jump through a lot of hoops. But we'll do our best for this little guy. But at least I know he's in a safe place. And he's under veterinary care.
At their monthly meeting on Thursday, June 19th, the Kingston Police Service Board received a presentation on a new community drug checking program that has already shown promise in improving public health and safety in the region. The initiative is part of Ontario's drug checking community, a leader in the delivery of these services and community-led monitoring of the unregulated drug supply. The program was launched by Toronto's drug checking service in 2019. The program offers drug users the ability to have their unregulated drugs tested before consumption to ensure they're not contaminated or in unexpected concentration. It also provides a snapshot of the unregulated drug supply market in Kingston. data that is made available to all those impacted and the general public through emergency alerts and monthly reports. Kingston became the first jurisdiction outside of Toronto to join the initiative in November 2024, with the long-term goal of establishing at least one drug checking site in each of Ontario's 29 public health unit regions. Locally, the program operates through the Integrated Care Hub on Montreal Street. Karen McDonald, Executive Director of Toronto's Drug Checking Service and Ontario's Drug Checking Community, presented an in-depth overview of the program structure, impact, and findings.
So our program is made up of three groups. There are collection sites, analysis sites, and then the central operating team. So collection sites are community agencies that are exempted to collect samples from and share results with service users. Their, you know, main role, like the Integrated Care Hub, is just to, you know, have existing and trusted relationships with people who use drugs, collect samples, share results, and really educate their communities about what it is that's circulating. Next, we have analysis sites. So these are the purple. We currently have three. These are clinical research or government labs that are exempted to analyze samples and report drug checking results. And we're super fortunate. These are, you know, scientific experts who are incredibly skilled at determining the composition of really any specimen, and we're using drugs. And then we have the central operating team. So that's the team that I run at St. Michael's Hospital, super small team. Our job is really just to make the lives of the collection sites and the analysis sites easier.
Justine McIsaac, Coordinator of Consumption and Treatment Services at Kingston's ICH, offered context on the implementation of the program in Kingston.
Just to give you some context as to why we decided to start drug checking in our community is because we have a bunch of people that are very unwell and are using substances that are very dangerous to not only the people that use them, but the greater community. And our goal with this program was to give people a better knowledge of what it was they were using, as well as the community. Initially, I piloted a project with a local group through Queens, which was called Spectra Plasmatics. I helped them write a grant to Health Canada to pilot their equipment with the support of the municipality as well. In turn, that allowed me to get the equipment for free, which is a $30,000 piece of equipment. And I have worked on that relationship with them since. The machine itself takes a very small amount of the substance or a piece of equipment that that person has used to inject the substance, and we will test that, and it'll tell us exactly what is in the substance that the person used.
McIsaac, drawing from firsthand experience at the ICH, emphasized that the program had an immediate life-saving impact.
Somebody presented a substance to me that looked like MDMA, which is considered a party drug. It's very casually used amongst young people in college, universities, things like that. This drug presented as if it was what it was, and it was not. It looked like MDMA. It was stamped as if it was MDMA, and it turned out to be pill-pressed fentanyl. Now, the risks for that individual who has no opioid dependency whatsoever, that would have been consequential and most likely would have resulted in death for that individual if they had not come in and tested that drugs. Because he brought that sample in and I was able to test it, I was able then to work with public health and formulate a community alert to warn people that there were substances in our community that looked like something else but actually weren't what they were presenting to be.
In her presentation, McDonald shared what they've uncovered about the unregulated drug supply. The primary focus was on fentanyl and other opioids. While a common fear is party drugs being laced with fentanyl, the more common case is fentanyl being contaminated with other substances or having unpredictable concentration.
We have checked over 8,000 samples that were not expected to be opioids, and we've actually only confirmed fentanyl or another high-potency opioid in 11 of those. So certainly not to say that it doesn't happen. The risks are incredibly high, but I do think there's just this general conception that this happens all the time. And what kind of worries me about that messaging is just that we're detracting from the population of people who are actually at risk. If we're putting all of our focus on you know, people who use cocaine and MDMA and their risk of being contaminated by with fentanyl, we're kind of ignoring the population of people who actually are at risk and dying.
In Toronto, only 3% of fentanyl samples tested were found to contain what users believed they were consuming. Although fewer samples have been collected in Kingston to date, the trend is similar.
And on the Kingston front, not a single fentanyl sample that has been collected by the Integrated Care Hub since we launched this service has met service users' expectations. So every single sample has been contaminated with unexpected drugs.
Fentanyl samples are often contaminated with other high-potency opioids, as well as central nervous system and respiratory depressants like benzodiazepines and animal tranquilizers. McIsaac noted that this contamination significantly impacts operations at the ICH, especially complicating overdose responses.
When we first opened, an opioid overdose response was pretty cut and dry. Now it has become so complicated that we've had to change our whole process of how we respond to overdoses to ensure that we're keeping people as safe as possible. So we're constantly on a learning curve as to how we can treat people appropriately and keep them as safe as possible.
In addition to contamination, the strength of fentanyl in the unregulated supply is highly unpredictable, with concentrations fluctuating drastically.
For one thing, what does that mean for the person who's using the drug? Are they experiencing withdrawal? But also think about if you were to flip it the other way. Someone's tolerance is kind of down because the fentanyl supply is quote unquote weaker. And then suddenly the next month it increases by 5 times the amount. Of course, the risk of overdose is going to be higher.
Members of the Kingston Police Service Board recently visited the collection site at the ICH. Board member Adam Coven remarked on the strong trust that has developed between service providers and people seeking services, a key factor in the program's effectiveness.
Going to the site yesterday was amazing for so many reasons, but one of the things that I applaud is that here in Kingston, which is the only center that we know of, the amount of trust that obviously has gone on because of your services, your staff, your support. Without breaching that trust to the people that are coming to you, which amazes me. I'm standing there with the chief and deputy police, and we have people that you're saying are coming in with their drugs and their testing. It's an amazing amount of trust.
Board Chair Jared Stearns asked the first question in the Q&A portion of the presentation.
If fentanyl is like so dirty or unpredictable, why is it the drug of choice for so many people?
Unfortunately, the population that I work with has opioid dependency, so they're physically dependent on it. Primarily, the population before bootleg fentanyl was introduced to the market, primarily people were using OxyContin. It was overprescribed. But we didn't see near the amount of deaths associated because it was prescription grade. People developed a tolerance to it. They knew how to dose themselves appropriately. This is kind of what's available in the illicit market. And really, it's, in my opinion, people just taking advantage of very vulnerable, sick people in the long run. But yeah, it's not necessarily about choice. It's about there's no other option for people in the illicit market. Obviously, from a treatment perspective, as a support worker, I'm always looking for ways and means to reduce people's risk of either their use or overdose, whether it be through methadone, Suboxone, Sublocade, things like that. But it's unfortunately, it's not a choice at this point. It's what's on the market.
And are you seeing overdoses daily?
Yes.
When asked how this information can be used to find and remove the toxic drug supply, McDonald and McIsaac both stated that this would require larger solutions, but the program can still be a level of intervention.
From my perspective, the supply is always going to be toxic if it's unregulated. I'm not sure, at this time, what our service and police can do to really clean up the supply. Interestingly, what we have seen is that one of the primary things that people, service users, do with their results is go back to the person they bought their drugs from and put kind of what we call grassroots pressure on the supply. So going back to someone and saying, I bought this, but I'm actually getting this. I don't want this thing. I'm either not going to use it, I'm going to go find it from someone else, or at least just providing that feedback so that's there as well.
just sharing the knowledge with each other too. Like I said, you know, ensuring that our constables that are out on road dealing with people every day, they have an understanding of what's going on in community and behaviors associated to drug use, and are well equipped to try and support and deal with some of that.
Finally, when asked what message they most wanted Kingston police to take away, McDonald and McIsaac offered the following.
Watching how complex people's mental health and substance use needs have become, I've also watched in the years that I've been doing this work, the expectations of police on road grow to an unrealistic expectation. I've watched police become police to crisis workers, to triage workers, to finding people shelter, to dealing with complex mental health and substance use needs, to responding to overdoses. This is really, I feel like, has really impacted policing. And so first off, I'd like to thank you guys for everything that you do. But I think the takeaway is that for me in working with this complex population is that, and please forgive me, but the intent is to get high, not to die. People are seeking momentary relief from like excruciating physical, mental, and emotional pain. And it's really the bigger picture as to what happened to these people along the way. It's not necessarily what's wrong with you, it's what happened to you, and how much we need to invest in caring for a very vulnerable, complex population, and looking for ways and means to help them not only deal with the traumas that they carry, but feel supported and accepted and develop new coping techniques for themselves. Unfortunately, drugs have a functional purpose for some people, and generally they start using drugs because they served a purpose for them. But as I've watched people go through this very complex, hard lifestyle, I've seen it create more chaos, more trauma, more hurt for these individuals, and it really doesn't get them any further. So I think the takeaway should be is, A, we need to be a lot kinder to our police that are doing the best they can in a community or communities with little resources to help this crisis, but that people are not enjoying this. They're not out living a free-for-all. This is not them not wanting to be better or not wanting to work or not wanting to have housing. It's their needs are just so complex, and they're just really sick, hurting people. And we need to remember that day in and day out, that these are still members of our community that need love and acceptance.
I guess key takeaways from me would be, first, that we need to accept in rare cases, fentanyl is not what is contaminating other things. In fact, it is fentanyl that is contaminated, and that is really what is driving this crisis. And, you know, we really do need timely and accessible information about what is circulating in the drug supply and public information, you know, regardless of whether you're focused on community safety, harm reduction, treatment, prevention. Understanding what it is that's in the drug supply is crucial. So I think just like, you know, the more information that we can try to generate and make publicly available, and then just really work together to respond. There is no, you know, there is no single response to this crisis clearly, and it is persisting. So I think, yeah, just as much collaboration as possible, kind of, you know, and just recognizing that everybody's doing their best, but also recognizing the incredibly important role that like each different stakeholder plays.
Before we wrap up this morning, we're going to run through your Friday forecast, a roundup of just some of the events Kingston has to offer this weekend. Tonight, you can head to Carlow Estates Winery from 6 to 9 p.m. for bingo in their Speakeasy Lounge. Hosted by drag performer Rowena Way, this 19-plus performance-packed bingo night blends cabaret flair with sassy prizes and wine by the glass. Your $10 reservation goes towards your first drink. In Springer Market Square at 6 p.m., there's free line and square dancing lessons with expert instructors. All ages and skill levels are welcome and no partners needed. Tomorrow on Saturday, July 19th, Sourfest at Daft Brewing runs from 12 to 8 p.m.
This all-day celebration of sour beer features live music by Nolan Hubbard and friends, sour offerings from 7 guest breweries, a charity draw, and $15 pizzas for ticket holders. Tickets are $10 in advance and available at eventbrite.ca or $15 at the door, including 2 drink tickets. Ages are 19 plus. On Sunday, July 20th, Yoga in the Park is from 10 to 11 a.m. in Battery Park. Enjoy a free outdoor yoga session led by downtown instructors. Just bring your mat and soak up the summer vibes by the water. Montreal Street Vintage Market runs from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Montreal Street between Princess and Queen. Enjoy open-air shopping with 20-plus local vendors offering handmade goods, vintage finds, and thrift treasures. Brought to you by the Montreal Street Collective. Pull Together for Epilepsy takes place from 12 to 3 p.m. at Confederation Park. This annual fire truck pull fundraiser supports individuals living with epilepsy and seizure disorders. Teams of 8 will pull a fire truck 100 feet to raise awareness and funds for Epilepsy Southeastern Ontario. Registration opens at 11 a.m. Once again, that was your Friday forecast pulled from our concerts and events calendar written by Ellie Sturton. Reach out today via cfrc.ca if you have a concert or event you'd like included on our online and on-air calendars. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. KPP Concerts has a stacked lineup of all-ages concerts happening at the Broom Factory through the summer into early fall. On June 27th, check out Housewife, followed by Friday's Child at the Broom Factory on July 11th. Then on August 10th, enjoy music from hip-hop artist Matt Mack, followed later by The Dirty Nil on September 19th. Then on September 26th, it's Petite Belle Ivo and neo-grunge icons The Bridge City Synergy.